The California Assembly has struck a deal on a bill on police use of force. On Insight, we'll hear from Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler about that, plus a preview of this weekend's California Democratic Party convention in San Francisco. Of the more than 20 presidential contenders, 14 are slated to be there. The Sacramento Black Book Fair takes place this weekend. Fair organizer Faye Kennedy and Sacramento-born poet Frederick K. Foote will be joining me in the studio. He will also read from some of his poetry. And we meet Cap Radio's new midday classical host, Jennifer Reason. She talks with morning classical host Kevin Doherty about her roots and about martial arts. She'll also share some of her favorite music. I'm Pamela Wu, and for Beth Ruyak, that's today on Insight. First, the news. Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Pamela Wu, in for Beth Ruyak. This is a big week in the California State Legislature. We've reached that point in the calendar where bills must pass the House where they originated. One item that's getting a lot of attention is a bill on police use of force. Also in political news, the California Democratic Party convention is this weekend in San Francisco. Of the more than 20 Democratic candidates for president, 14 are slated to attend. Their presence is a testament to California's influence in the 2020 election, not just because our state has moved its primary up to March, but also because California Democrats have long set the policy agenda for other blue states. I am joined now by Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler. He joins us from the Capitol to talk about bills at the State House and the road to the White House. Hello, Ben.
Good morning, Pamela.
Good morning. Let's start with what's happening in the legislature. There's a lot of public interest in the use of force bill. Now a deal's been struck, and it passed the Assembly with no opposition. So given how polarizing this issue is, how was a deal reached and what's in that deal?
All right. So, yes, this was the big news. The deal was struck late last week, but the bill passed the Assembly yesterday. And I should tell you that if you're wondering what the sounds are behind me, I'm here in the Assembly Press Bay as the chamber is just about ready to gavel in for its final day of this key week. It's known as House of Origin Week because by the end of this week, all bills must pass the Chamber of Origin. Senate bills must pass the Senate. Assembly bills must pass the Assembly. And it's that deadline that drove the use of force deal last week. Now, a lot of times you get a deal right now or a bill gets through the House of Origin with promises to keep working on it through the end of session, which this year is going to be in mid-September. Not so in this case. In this case, in point of fact, it was essentially a final deal. There are still a couple of minor details yet to be worked out as the bill moves through the Senate. However, for all intents and purposes, this is the framework of the final bill. And so here's what it includes. Officers will only be able to use lethal force when it is necessary and if there are no other options. And that's widely viewed as higher than the existing legal standard that the use of deadly force is legal if a reasonable officer would have acted similarly in that situation. But the bill language leaves out a specific definition of necessary, and that would leave interpretation up to the legal system to figure out on a case-by-case basis. A couple other provisions in this use of force deal that show how both groups were willing to compromise. The proposed law also states that an officer's conduct leading up to the shooting will be considered. That was big for proponents of this bill. But so too will the suspect's behavior and a nod to law enforcement. And there's language in the bill that requires police to use other alternatives. We're talking about de-escalation or less lethal options before using deadly force. But these requirements are a statement of intent, not a specific checklist.
What does this bill's future look like?
So it passed the Assembly yesterday. It moves to the Senate. There are still a few relatively minor details yet to be worked out, and then it would need to, assuming there are amendments in the Senate, it would have to come back to the Assembly. But the real heavy lifting on this bill, everyone is saying, has already been done. And so there are things to work out that there just wasn't enough time to work out last week to get amendments processed, to get the bill up in time for this deadline, but it's moving forward. And of course, this is a big deal for Sacramento. This bill first came up last year, and there were previous years' efforts, efforts, but new momentum last year after the Sacramento police shooting of Stephon Clark. Now, of course, earlier this year, Sacramento County District Attorney Anne Marie Schubert did not charge the officers who shot Clark, and that gave yet another round of momentum and propelled the negotiations that really had been going on over the winter after last year's bill failed. And now we finally seem to have the makings of a deal.
Let's talk about another bill that's getting a lot of attention, what's being referred to as the Dynamics Bill. This bill impacts Lyft, Uber, other gig economy workers and contractors. Where does that stand?
That bill just passed the Assembly yesterday evening. It was a really long session yesterday. They gaveled in around 10, and they went into the evening hours. I don't think it'll be quite as long today, but they still have a fair amount of work to do in the Assembly today. A little less work to do, by the way, over in the Senate. So this bill, we call it the Dynamics Bill because it's a court ruling that propelled these negotiations last year, or these discussions last year. Legislative leaders were not willing to act on such a complex topic last year, and that pushed the debate into this year. Labor and business groups are trying to work out deals, and there's so many industries are affected, including ours of journalism. And it's about when an employee is an employee, when a contractor is a contractor, when should a contractor actually be classified as an employee, and there could be different questions to weigh for all of these different industries. Truck drivers, hairdressers, journalists. So because it is so complex, it's going to take some time to work out. And it was the author of the bill yesterday was clear that it's still a work in progress. So unlike the use of force bill, which was passed with without any no votes, a couple of assembly members voted no, and one from each party, and then changed their votes to not voting after the fact. Unlike there, where there was wide praise for a deal and this is how the legislative process should work, the legislative process is still working on this Dynamics Bill, and we will see where it goes in the coming months.
Well, what bills that you and other political watchers thought were sure to make it through this legislative session just fizzled? And conversely, are there ones that are making their way through that are kind of a surprise?
So there's a couple topics that I'm watching, and one are charter school bills, and another are rent and tenant bills. So the charter bills, a couple relatively smaller ones have made it through the House of Origin so far, and the governor signed one about transparency for charter schools that had broad support, and the charters themselves were neutral. But you've had this historic tension between the charter schools and the teachers unions, there's generally been the status quo holding for quite some time. Now, at the same time, though, as you can hear the gavel behind me, this year, with an expanded Democratic majority and with a new governor who was opposed by charter schools in the primary last year, teachers unions have seen hope for pushing some significant charter school legislation through, talking about moratoriums or caps and new restrictions on when they can be authorized. And bills, there was one debate, I want to say it was earlier this week, might have been late last week, where a bill came up by surprise, and it got through but barely, and a lot of moderate Democrats weren't happy. So we're waiting to see what happens today with these two remaining charter school bills, one in the Senate and one in the Assembly. We're also looking at rent bills, and of course with the rent being, as the chant goes, too damn high, that's a chant that tenant groups have been chanting quite a bit. So the rent cap bill did pass the Assembly last night after some significant amendments that addressed concerns from Apartment Association, Realtors Association, interest groups like that. We're still waiting to see what happens to a bill with tenant protections about when tenants can and cannot be evicted. That bill would need to come up today, or it would be done for the year.
I'm talking with Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief, Ben Adler. Ben, the California Democratic Convention is taking place in San Francisco this weekend, and 14 of the more than 20 declared presidential candidates will be there. So what can attendees expect to hear?
Well, we're going to have 14 different presidential candidates of the, what, I think we're at 22 or 23 or so, but 14 different presidents. Yes, I know. And I don't think anyone is going to be too frustrated as to how we might have lost count of precisely how many are coming. So the big absence is going to be Joe Biden, the former vice president, the front runner in the race. He has not been attending events like this in other states either, so he's not coming to this one. In fact, he'll be campaigning in Ohio over the weekend. But let me run through the schedule of who we expect to speak and when. So Saturday morning, we're going to hear from Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, California's own senator, of course, and Beto O'Rourke. Saturday afternoon, Kirsten Gillibrand, Tulsi Gabbard, Pete Buttigieg, Eric Swalwell, the California congressman, Amy Klobuchar, John Hickenlooper and Jay Inslee. And then Sunday morning, Bernie Sanders, Julian Castro, and John Delaney. So those are the 14 who we expect to hear from. And we're also going to hear from a lot of other big California names. Gavin Newsom, of course, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, will be there, and several of the members of Congress who are taking these elevated national roles in investigating the president, Maxine Waters and Adam Schiff, they are going to be speaking as well.
From the from a policy perspective, what do you expect some of the other big topics to be?
So it's interesting. I had a story run this morning about how California's so deep blue that the progressive policies that California has pushed, which have long been on the agenda in other blue states because of California, they're really being brought up nationally. And perhaps this would have happened organically. Perhaps the rest of the nation, or at least Democrats in the rest of the nation, are where California is now anyway. But there's also the fact that California has this now March primary. We're not voting in June, we're voting in March. That actually means that vote-by-mail ballots are going to be sent out by counties to you and me and every other voter who votes by mail. And, of course, in Sacramento County and an increasing number of counties right now, every voter votes by mail. So those ballots are going to go out the day of the Iowa caucuses. Let's stop and think about that. Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, the early states. And then in early March, there's a slew of Super Tuesday states. California is one of those states. California has by far the most delegates in the Democratic presidential primary. They're awarded by congressional districts once you reach a certain viability, 15%. Any candidate above 15% is able to claim some of the delegates. So there are a lot of delegates up for grabs, and candidates are loath to not get any of them, to be skipped over. On the other hand, it's really hard to compete in California, right? It's very expensive. So you've got all of these candidates coming out here glad to get the media attention, except for the one candidate who arguably does not need immediate media attention, Vice President Biden.
This sort of makes March 3rd like a super duper Tuesday, Ben.
Yes, I think that pun and many others may be made between a super duper number of times between now and March.
You mentioned members of Congress appearing this weekend. You know, Robert Mueller held this rather unusual press conference yesterday, and he seemed to suggest that the ball is in Congress's court if action is to be taken against President Trump for alleged collusion or obstruction. Do you expect the topic of impeachment in the White House to be widely discussed at this weekend's convention?
Well, I think if the candidates themselves don't discuss it, they're going to get a lot of questions from media. I mean, there's going to be national media descending on San Francisco. The Moscone Center is where the convention is taking place. So, yes, and I think you're going to see some, you know, well, Nancy Pelosi was at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco yesterday, and what do you think the first question was about? It was just a couple of hours after Robert Mueller had spoken publicly for the first time. So, of course, she was asked about that. Now, the presidential candidates have this tightrope to walk. There's, you know, they're going to be campaigning on their policies, but they're also mindful that Democrats seem to be very interested in which candidate they think is best equipped to take on President Trump and go toe-to-toe with him and defeat him. The electability question. So you're going to have the policy debate, the electability debate, and how each candidate chooses to use his or her time. I'm told that each candidate will have more than 5 minutes, but I don't have an exact number of minutes. It will be interesting to see. And I'm also going to be very curious to what extent the candidates talk about California-specific policies, or if they keep their speeches, you know, their elevator speeches, their campaign speeches, their stump speeches general.
That's going to be one very busy convention, and you'll be there?
Oh, yes. Cap Radio will be here in force. And speaking of being here in force, I have walking into the press bay Democratic Assembly Member Shirley Weber, the author of the Use of Force Bill. And we're glad to have you with us this morning. And we're kind of zigzagging back for our listeners to the topic that we started with. But it's of such concern to, I think, Sacramento residents because of the police shooting of Stephon Clark and the central place in the debate that this has taken in our community that we thought it would be great to have you join us. So thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I appreciate it.
At one point, not long before a deal, it looked like the whole thing might just go up in flames. What was the turning point that led to a deal being struck between yourself and the civil liberties and community activist groups on your side and law enforcement groups on the other?
Well, I mean, it's hard to pinpoint any particular issue because this was such a complicated issue and with a lot of folks participating in it. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I mean, when I was leaving and coming back here on Sunday night, I had a very heavy heart, not knowing where this bill was going to land and still fighting to make sure that we could get folks to the table to make some reasonable adjustments and hopefully move folks to neutral. So I think also one of the factors was that many of the members on the floor who are very close to law enforcement had said to them, something's got to change. Something has got to change. And you need to talk to Weber. So as a result, there was a constant push for them to meet with me by the members on the floor. And they kept asking me, have you met? Have you met? And so that became important in terms of them understanding that this body wanted some change. They wanted some reasonableness in terms of coming together. So that was a part of it that was there. The governor got involved, and maybe people realized, okay, that it's going to happen. Law enforcement kept saying, we got to make a change. And so that was all a part of it.
You're hearing us speak a little more quietly now because the prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance are happening here on the Assembly floor on this final day of session this week before the House of Origin deadline for bills to pass this chamber. A lot of times there are votes at this House of Origin deadline to keep a bill moving, not a final deal. Why was this deal able to be a final deal?
I think because we all wanted to make sure that all parties, because it is so complicated, that all parties would still be participating. We didn't want to leave it hanging and say, well, we'll make changes in the next House. We wanted to make sure that those changes were done here so that people knew what they were voting for because it was just that important. I don't think we could have sold folks on saying, well, we're going to make changes at the next House. Trust us. Even though they trusted me, they wanted to know exactly what it was going to look like because that was very, very important.
And I wanted to ask you, you mentioned, law enforcement needing to come to the table. Did you ever have to make a pitch to your supporters and say, hey, you know, this bill isn't going to be everything that you want? You know, for example, there's no specific definition of necessary except a bit of one in the intent language. It's not laid out in the hard and fast language of the bill. Was it hard for you to bring your backers along to the bargaining table?
I had a couple of meetings with them at certain points of time as the bill was going to change, assuring them that certain things would be in the bill. And I think the fact that I took it so seriously and I worked so hard, every last one of them said, we trust you. We know that you're going to do the best you can for this community. And I said, and I wouldn't leave you with a bill that was nothing, that really had good intent language, that had definition of circumstances, that all the things that we wanted. So we constantly went back and forth saying, what did we attempt to accomplish? Because if you get caught up in only the language itself without what you want, you may feel a sense of loss. But if you say, what were we out there to do? We wanted to change when you can use force. We want to change it from being reasonable to necessary. We wanted to talk about totality of circumstances. So all these things we talked about, we said, all of those things are there in some form of the bill. And so people felt comfortable with the fact that we may have been changing some language and a few things around, but ultimately it was there.
And we're hearing the Pledge of Allegiance right now in the Assembly Chamber, and it's interesting that we have you at this moment, the prayer and the pledge. You spoke yesterday about how your church was praying for you, and the Pledge of Allegiance to this country, the country that allowed for this kind of debate. What emotions are you feeling at this moment as this bill that you've worked on 2 years, maybe more, is moving forward?
Well, I'm excited about it. I'm excited, first of all, that most of my colleagues complimented me on the fact that I was willing, I was patient, and I was accessible, and I was willing to have conversations with them and with others. And I didn't try to push something through in a rushed manner. I think they all appreciated that. I just talked to a member on the floor who was saying he didn't know if I recognized it, and with the 7 years, the element in this floor has changed. And the fact that we could get that many votes on this bill was amazing. And I think it goes to my staff, it goes to the advocates, because many of them were walking the halls and being respectful, but nonetheless being pushing to say, you've got to make change. You know, the timing was right, all those kinds of things. I'm a very spiritual person. I rely heavily upon my church and my God to give me direction. And that doesn't mean I'm one of these far-right kind of religious people, because I don't impose my religion on others. It is designed to make me a better person. And as a result of that, I think that people will become better because of who I am. And I relied heavily upon my church. I asked them to pray for me before I took the bill. I asked them to pray every step of the way when we decided to hold the bill last year. I asked them, you know, for prayer to strengthen me, not to just to say you can move everything, but to give me what I needed in terms of internal strength to basically be able to carry the bill with some sense of dignity and take it to the end of the line.
Democratic Assembly Member Shirley Weber of San Diego, the author of the bill that is strengthening the legal standard for when police can use deadly force in California. Thank you for stopping by on CAP Radio.
Thank you so very much, and have a great day.
And you as well. So, Pamela, just getting in before the Chamber of Origin deadline for lawmakers and bills today, and Dr. Weber, just getting in before our deadline for the end of this segment.
Indeed. Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler. Thank you for the update, Ben.
You're welcome.
You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. Welcome back to Insight, live on Capital Public Radio. I'm Pamela Wu. The Sacramento Black Book Fair is returning for its sixth year. The fair celebrates the work of African-American authors, poets, and artists. It features live music, poetry, games, storytelling, and activities for the younger crowd, too, at the Brickhouse Art Gallery Kids Zone. The festival's theme this year is creating a legacy. For more about the Sacramento Black Book Fair, which takes place in Oak Park tomorrow and Saturday, I am joined in the studio by one of the fair's organizers, Faye Kennedy, and participating author Frederick K. Foote. Faye and Fred, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Faye, this is the sixth year of the Sacramento Black Book Fair. For people who haven't been before, how would you describe it?
It is an opportunity to meet and engage authors both locally, regionally, and nationally, to talk with them firsthand, and also to visit the beautiful Oak Park. We'll be in Oak Park at five different venues. Like you said earlier, we will have a kids zone. So it's a place where the entire family can come and spend the day with us, particularly on Saturday, June 1st. And then we encourage folks to get more information to visit our website, just like the name, SacramentoBlackBookFair.com.
What do you see as the mission, the goal of the Black Book Fair?
So I think, number one, we would like to introduce to the public books and literature by folks of African descent, and particularly young folks, because it's really complements our theme, building a legacy. So we want people to be, we want young people who are in their teens or younger, when they become older, to enjoy literature and particularly to know about folks like Fred and others who are writers and authors.
There is so much diversity within the works by Black authors. Tell us a bit about the spectrum that people can expect to be represented at the fair.
Sure. So you have people who do fiction, nonfiction. There will be children's authors. There will be folks who write self-help books. There will be folks who write primarily what we would call academic works. So the spectrum will be there. So every year, for example, we have folks who write children's books. They come over to the Kid Zone and read their books and introduce their works to children and family. So it's an opportunity for folks to really see firsthand and have an opportunity to engage with those authors and writers and everything.
Fred, you are one of the participating authors. What is your involvement in the fair going to be?
This year I'm going to be in a writer circle. I'll be with other writers, and we'll be discussing the types of things we write, And I will be presenting a workshop on getting published online. So try to help people who are aspiring to see their words in print or on the screen. I'll try to help make that a reality.
What first attracted you to taking part in the fair, and what does it mean to you to take part in it?
Well, what first attracted me was Dr. Coven and Faye and all the other people that were working on it. They always do really quality stuff, and I've been interested in writing, and it just kind of dovetailed that this came. And it's a great community event because not only does it do all of the things Faye say, but it's kind of like a homecoming. It's kind of like a family reunion mm-hmm. where people from all over and from our past and hopefully our future get together. It's a great feel to the event.
Faye, as we mentioned, the fair is now in its sixth year. Mm-hmm. How have you seen it grow over the years, change over the years?
Sure. So one of the ways we've seen it grow as well as change, initially the first 3 years, we were kind of ambitious. It was actually a Friday evening, all day Saturday, and then half day Sunday. We were just totally exhausted. And then we listened to folks who participated, and they gave us a lot of feedback. We were also really widespread. So we went from Women's Civic Improvement Center to three blocks over at one of the venue was the McGeorge Library. And, you know, Sacramento gets to be pretty hot. The first 2 years, we were like at 105, 106 degrees. And that was a long walk for people. So we came back 3 years later. We revamped. So now we're just Friday evening, all day Saturday. And we're much more compact. We only have five venues now. And it's everything is within two to three blocks walking, really less than that and everything. So we listen to folks who give us some very positive and constructive feedback and everything.
Mother Nature will cooperate with you this weekend,
yes.
too.
It's going to be a lot cooler, yes.
I'm talking with Sacramento Black Book Fair organizer Faye Kennedy and participating author Frederick K. Foote. Fred, you've brought something to read today. What are you going to share with us?
Well, I have a poem that I wrote a while back, and I called it Travels with C, and the C is like Charlie. And the reason I called it C was I had friends who were suffering from cancer. My brother was dying of cancer. So I said, I'll write this little piece. And then I wrote it, and I called it Travels with C, and I'll read it to you. It is my constant companion, reaching out to touch my community of friends, rendering them thin, binding to us to the same end, but with different paces. Step by step, we rise to fall into the memories of others.
It is short, but very impactful. Mm-hmm. And I think that listening to it, I feel like anyone who has seen someone suffer with C mm-hmm. can relate to it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who heard this, and he said, I thought that was cocaine, but it works for cocaine too.
But I knew what you meant.
Yes.
When did you begin writing poetry?
About 2013, I started writing poetry.
2013. What inspired that?
I was at City College, and I took a class in writing poetry, and I kind of liked some of the things that you could do with it. And so since then, I've been dabbling in that.
Your poems are brief but impactful, like I said. Would you like to read another for
sure.
us? We have the time.
All right. This one's called Snowbound Train, and it's about the snow train that goes to Reno that we used to take all the time. Snowbound Train. Reno bound to a Nevada ghost town on a snow train. Through thunder, rain, wind, and snow, long delays in whiteout winterland, the Donner Party comes to mind as we consume cheeseburgers and red wine.
What inspired that one?
We did get stuck up there on time.
And did you have a burger?
Yes, and they were running out of food, so we ended up with burgers and red wine.
So there's another relatable
yes.
one.
Yes.
Faye, this year's fair theme is creating a legacy. Mm-hmm. How is that theme going to be on display throughout the weekend?
Sure. So we're going to have various events. We're going to have authors. They're going to be writing circles, author circles where people can come together. So people may be grouped, whether they're write fiction, nonfiction, children's writers. And so it's going to be carried out that way. We'll also, the Brick House Art Gallery, that will be hosting an art exhibit talking about the whole idea of fathers and fatherhood, so people can come to the art gallery and view the wonderful exhibit. But also there will be other authors, and there will be poetry, there will be music. So it's going to be a theme that's carried out in multiple ways and in multiple mediums and everything.
So looking forward then, what is the legacy you desire for the Black Book Fair?
So we would like everyone to really understand that through literature that they can really enrich themselves, that they may not be able to travel to many different places, but reading a particular book or a series of books can really transform them. And so we're really excited. And we really want parents to bring the children out. And one of the things we always like to say, one of the things that I like about the Black Book Fair is that it's free. Everything is free. You just have to bring a little money to buy some books if you would like, purchase some food. But the events themselves that we create are free and open to the public and everything.
Fred, what do you hope folks who attend the Black Book Fair walk away with?
Well, I think on the legacy theme, every time you write something, every time you print something or draw something or manufacture something, you leave a legacy. And we leave that legacy to people who enjoy it or comment on it, and that creates the legacy mm-hmm. in them. So we transport people when we provide them with art. And hopefully that will become part of them and they will pass that legacy mm-hmm. on.
Yes.
Community members are being encouraged to donate books by Black authors to
yes.
the book drive as well that's taking place. Who will that book drive benefit? What will happen to those books?
Thank you very much. So probably what we will do is identify particular organizations. So one of the organizations that I'm going to throw the hat in for, because we've been working with them for the past 3 years, is Mustard Seed. Mustard Seed is a program that serves children without homes or who are homeless. And so we really want to make sure that segment of our population is included in everything. But in the past, we've provided books to like the Oak Park Community Center, Daryl Roberts, the Roberts Family Development Center. So each year we identify programs that we think that would enjoy the books and everything. So, yeah.
The Sacramento Black Book Fair takes place tomorrow. It's kicking off with an event at the Guild Theater. Saturday, it's happening at the Women's Civic Improvement Center at mm-hmm. 35th and Broadway in the heart of Oak Park. We're going to put a link to the full schedule on our website, capradio.org/insight. Sacramento Black Book Fair organizer Faye Kennedy and participating author Frederick K. Foote, thank you for being with us and best wishes for a great event.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very mm-hmm. much.
You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. This is Insight live on Capital Public Radio. I'm Pamela Wu. This week's sound advice is a little bit different in that we're keeping it in the Cap Radio family. Cap Radio Music's morning classical host, Kevin Doherty, introduces us to our new midday host, Jennifer Reason. Reason is no stranger to Sacramento audiences. She graduated from Sac State with a degree in piano performance and has a demanding concert schedule. So it came as a little bit of a surprise when, during a conversation with Kevin Doherty, she said, as a child, she didn't really like practicing the piano.
So my mom is a piano teacher, and she had the rule of you will study until you're 18 in my house. And I just was not on board at all. I would literally throw fits or objects such as my shoes, pillows, like at her. And, you know, be sent to my room, just tantrums. Like, I hate this. I hate you. Why are you so mean to me?
Why didn't you like it that much?
I think I just wanted to be doing literally anything else.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Very good. Well, we'll dig a little bit more. We'll find out a little bit more about that in just a second. As this is a sound advice segment, let's take a listen to a little music. And Jen, you told me recently that this next piece is constantly in your head, so much so that you almost don't like to admit it. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's always there. It follows me around. This is Dvorak's Carnival Overture, and I don't know what it is about it. It's just so fun.
It's a pretty celebratory piece for sure. Yeah. So what is it about that piece? Where'd you first hear it?
Gosh, I heard it years and years ago and was like, God, what is that? It's really that's on loop in my head, and it got solidified. I did a European tour last year with an orchestra, and that was the opening piece. And so now that earworm is in there forever. And apparently I could be seen from backstage quasi-conducting it.
Well, so you were talking about when you were a kid that you really didn't want to take piano lessons or practice. In fact, you threw some tantrums, but yet here you are now. When did you decide that you wanted to pursue this career in music?
Well, you know, there's multiple stages, and I have to be grateful to my mother who tolerated said tantrums, and she eventually arrived at just flat out bribery. So rather than an allowance, I got a practice allowance. And if I did 5 days in a row, you know, that's a trip to the toy store. So that kind of started the economic incentive, if you will. And then I got my first little gig when I was 12, and I had to get a little worker's permit and everything. And it was playing with a gospel band. I know, it's really cute. Sunday nights at this church down the street. And, you know, I was making $25 a week. Watch out. As a 12-year-old, that is bags of gold. And, you know, and I got to go say all my friends, oh, do you not have $20? Because I do. And that was like, oh, wait a minute. I see a future here. But, you know, then the teenage years happen, high school happens, and I needed an adult inspiration. And it was right about 16 that I met my teacher and forever mentor, Richard Cianco, and he really solidified the path.
Well, that's great. And that's a bit of a segue into our next selection of music, too, which I'm excited about. And when it comes to this piece of music, he kind of threw the gauntlet down, didn't he?
Well, yes.
In a way.
In a way. I like a challenge, and I like being told I can't do something. So I had just started my undergrad at Sac State, my little 18-year-old self. And one of the things I really enjoy about Richard Cianco is his vast performance skill and how much he's out there actually doing it. And I saw him give a recital of Latin American piano music, and he played the Andalusia Suite by Ernesto Lecuona, and it blew my teenage mind. And I marched right up to him and said, I'm going to play that. And he said, no, you are not. You cannot. Maybe, but not now, but I will. And that just became the ceaseless, relentless goal, is I was going to play that piece. And I did. I put it on my junior recital, and I've performed it innumerable times since then. So,
would you say you perform it better than him now?
I will never say any such thing.
Fair enough. Well, tell us a little bit about the selection.
So this is a really cool piece. It's six movements, and this is the final one, the Malaguena.
Thank you. That is Richard Chanco playing the Malaguena, the last movement from the Ana Lucia Suite. I'm Kevin Daugherty, morning classical host on Cap Radio, and I'm here with our new midday classical host, Jennifer Reason. And Jennifer's telling us a little bit about her story through music. We just heard Richard Chanco, and Richard had a really big influence on your piano playing, but he's also sort of continually challenged you as well, right? There was a time that you had to make a choice between piano and another activity that was a really big part of your life. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, he's been a guiding force in a number of decisions. And I come from, in addition to a musical family, a very martial arts driven family. If you're going to hold your own in my sibling lineup, you will study martial arts seriously. So I have a black belt. Many of my siblings have black belts as well. And, you know, I was really torn for a long time because, as you can imagine, that takes about as much dedication as studying solo classical piano does. And, you know, there's lots of sparring, lots of training. We were in a very, very serious dojo and was, you know, training on cement. And you will do push-ups in the parking lot until your knuckles are bloody. And
oh, my goodness. I can't even do push-ups on the carpet with on my knuckles.
Oh, another life. Yes. So I don't know. I came into my lesson with bloody fingers one too many times. And one day Richard said, "That's it. You will choose."
Oh, my goodness.
Piano or this. So piano won.
Wow. That is quite a story. But hey, you know what? Taekwondo really leads to the discipline of practicing piano. And now without that, you have more time to challenge yourself. And I know you. I know you like a challenge. You already said that, you know, mm-hmm. Somebody tells you no, you're ready. Tell us about your introduction to piano concerto repertoire. You didn't start with an easy one.
No, and I spent a long time, as a lot of pianists do, I think, you know, alone in your practice room preparing solo material. And when I first got to Sac State, was first my exposure to chamber music and collaborative music of any kind. And we were studying concertos in a two piano version. So one person would have the orchestral reduction and one person would have the solo. And I got the Shostakovich second piano concerto, and just playing that with another person and just that impactful music and how stunning, especially the second movement is. It was just this mind-blowing moment of, oh, you can do this together and there's just nothing like this. I love it.
Tell us what we're listening for. That's going to be our next selection. What are we listening for?
Sure. So this is his second piano concerto and it's the second movement, the slow movement.
You know, I'll say just to the ear, it almost sounds kind of simple. And I know that Shostakovich, and I know it's anything but simple. What are you thinking when you're playing this, or what makes it hard to play? What's the challenge there?
You know, honestly, it's the outer movements that are the technical challenge. But sometimes simplicity is the most beautiful thing.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Truly. The second movement from Shostakovich's second piano concerto. Well, Jennifer, as a graduate of Sacramento State, you were already a staple in the community, but, you know, you're also the artistic director of the choral group RSVP. You're the music director of the opera-leaning collective Rogue Music Project with me, by the way. We're in that together. And a member of the New Music Ensemble City Water. You're so busy. Why add radio to that already packed schedule?
Well, I think what's missing from everything you just said is the ongoing conversation about music. In this job, I get to talk about it every day and talk about it with people who listen and love it the way I do. And that's so fun.
Yeah, yeah. And you're brand new to radio, too. I mean, you've only been doing it for about a year. What brought you to it? How did you get this job?
Pure an accidental twist of fate, honestly. It had never crossed my mind as a possibility ever before this. And in the guise of the two groups that you just said, RSVP was on Insight, as was City Water. And I was one of the people that was involved in the interview, thinking I was just there promoting my own concert series, you know, and maybe a month after one of those, the music director, Paul Conley, called me out of the nowhere and said, "Hi, I'm Paul. Has anyone ever said to you that you have a radio voice?" I said, "What? No, no one's ever said that to me." So that's kind of how it started. And he asked me, did I want to consider being a stand-in host? Like, I don't know. I don't know what that is. What does this mean? So,
well, thank goodness. And of course, Jennifer is talking about Paul Conley, the managing editor for music and arts here at Cap Radio. And thank goodness for Paul making that call to you. That is very, very lucky for us. We talked about City Water just a little bit ago, and this is sort of getting into our next selection of music here. But you have an affinity for new music, but I know that that's not necessarily everybody's cup of tea, and it wasn't yours either at first. So how did you kind of make that change? When did that happen?
You know, all roads lead back to Richard Cianco. We'll just say that. I was a self-professed rabid new music hater. You know, as 20-year-olds will be, we know everything. We're immovable. Got it figured out. Thank you very much. And I just thought it was the stupidest, most abrasive thing to ever happen. And why would anybody delve into this quote-unquote art form? And you know, he's like, stop talking. Let me help you. And you will play this and you will like it. I'm like, no, I won't, though. I won't. And here I am. And now I, you know, I do like it. And it's amazing to be able to make new music and to drive our own cultural conversation and heritage forward and work with living composers and find our sound. That who are we as Americans? And, you know, it's there's so much beautiful, amazing music being made, and we get to be a part of it. It's amazing.
Yeah, like this next piece that you're going to play for us right now. Tell us, I mean, you played this with City Water, right?
I did, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about it.
So this is the Concerto for Percussion and Piano Trio, which just as a genre all by itself is so much fun to even say. Who's ever heard of that type of concerto? But this is Kenji Bunch. He's from New York. He's a younger man. And this is the On Trio performing, AHN. They're sisters. They came to Sac State, blew my mind, you know. So then I told City Water we had to play this piece.
That's got a groove to it,
doesn't
for sure,
it?
Huh? Oh, my goodness. That's not something you hear in everyday classical music, for sure.
No, I think that was a drum kit.
Very cool. That was the On Trio performing the piano trio and percussion,
that's
yes?
Right.
Yeah, by composer Kenji Bunch. Well, I know for you, Jennifer, it's not all music all the time, even though it might seem like it because you do so much of it. But what do you do in your spare time?
Well, once I was forced to give up my love for martial arts, something had to fill that hole. And, you know, I really, really enjoy the outdoors. So I've been lucky enough to put together a group of fellow musicians. And we go and we backpack sometimes a week, sometimes a day. We hike, just see the natural world.
I love that you do that to get away from music, and yet you're still backpacking and hiking with musicians.
I know.
But still, you have to have that
but
community.
It's silent.
Yeah.
No notes.
Well, and I also know that it's not all classical music. As a matter of fact, classical music wasn't really your first love, was it?
No, it wasn't. And I was brought up in a household where my mom liked Mozart and Chopin, but my dad liked rock and roll and blues. And much to her chagrin, my first album from him was Metallica. When I was 10, here, honey, here's some real music. I have a love for heavy metal, and I'm not sorry about it.
Yeah, don't apologize mm-hmm. for it. Well, and this next clip is pretty cool, too, because we're not going too far outside the box here, but tell us a little bit about what you brought for our final clip of the day.
It's just important to note that a lot of these musicians are classically trained and studied at conservatories and could only carry off this technique and this ferocity and, you know, that sort of thing with good training. So there's that. But much to my extreme pleasure, Metallica and the San Francisco Symphony did an almost 3-hour concert. Mind-blowing. So this is an orchestrated collaboration with that orchestra and Metallica.
All right, let's listen.
That was Cap Radio Music's morning classical host, Kevin Doherty, introducing us to our new midday classical host, Jennifer Reason. You can hear her from 10 in the morning to 2 in the afternoon every weekday on Cap Radio Music at 88.9 FM. That is Insight for today. I'm Pamela Wu. Insight is produced by Kate Gonzalez and Cody Dravel. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer is Anthony Van Hook. Our senior producer is Helen Barrington, and Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We are back on Monday with another week of live shows. Thanks for joining us.